As you know, in this area, most things are done by committee and committee decisions. And when it was time to select a speaker for this conference, I had solicited tapes from several of the tapers, and I listened to Jack's tape, and I said, well, and on his tape, he had made the comment that at a conference he was at, that all of the speakers had gotten a letter, and he'd only gotten a telephone call, and it was funny. I said, well, you know what, we're going to be real classy. I'm going to write him a letter, and then we'll follow it up with a telephone call. And true enough, we wrote him a letter, and the letter said, we are considering you as one of our speakers and would like to know if you would be available on such and such a date to speak at our conference. I thought that was real cool. True enough, the committee heard his tape and unanimously decided to select him as our speaker. So I called him and I said, Jack, this is Laura Zeitlin from Chicago, and did you get our letter? We haven't heard anything from you. He said, first time I've ever gotten a letter that they're considering me being a speaker. Well, I said, we just kind of like wanted to know if you would be available if you were chosen. So that was my first introduction to Jack, but I loved his tape. That's what I tried to make an amends, and I know that you're going to enjoy him as much as I have. Jack.
Thank you, Laura, and now I'll tell you the truth about the story. I just can't stand rejection. And I thought she was one of them sadistic Al-Anon members. Who had written me a letter telling me I was considered and would follow it up shortly with a letter telling me the rest of them had rejected it. My name's Jack Sullivan. I'm an alcoholic. I'm also the abused adult child of an Al-Anon. My sobriety date is the 21st day of August of 1962. I didn't say that to impress you, it just impresses me. And my home group for the past 26 years has been the South Louisville Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It meets in Louisville, Kentucky. On Wednesday night, it's an open speaker meeting. If you're ever in Louisville, we invite you to come by. I think it's the best home group in the world. And if you have a home group and you don't think yours is the best in the world, then my advice to you would just stay where you are. Don't go around and screw up somebody else's. Just stay there. I'd like to thank Laura and the committee for inviting me. We've had a good time. It was nice. We came Thursday, and an old friend of mine from up here who got transferred to Louisville one time and then came back, Fred and his wife came by Thursday, and we went out to Arlington Park. I love to see racetracks. I'm from horse country down there. I come from where they run the Kentucky Derby, and I've been involved around there since I was about 11 years old. They have an alcohol and drug abuse program on the backside of the racetracks now, and they try to help their employees. And the guy that runs the program at Churchill Downs is a good friend of mine, and I go over there and assist him wherever I can. So, and I enjoy the horses and seeing the tracks. And when talking to Fred, and Laura invited us to come Thursday, that he said, "Well, we'll come by and we'll go with you." So I appreciated that. And his friend Jack came over today, and it was good to see him. And we have some old friends, Tom and Mona, here, and so we've just had a blast. I caught your train yesterday and went downtown to the Sears Tower and let everybody know that you're a tourist. You just stand there and look straight up. And they don't have to ask if you know, they know where you're from and whatever. So we've just had a real, real super time since we've been here. I have my wife with me. I don't go anywhere without her. She's been a member of the Al-Anon family group for the past 30 years. She doesn't like to speak from behind these podiums. They make her real nervous, and so she doesn't like to do that. But at our home group and many other areas, she's very good with people, working one-on-one with them and helping them in that area. And everybody has their own niche in this program. And so it's super good for her. But I don't never go anywhere without her. It was just the first time I was ever asked to do something like this many years ago. I discussed it with my sponsor, and I told him I didn't feel comfortable going and leaving her home and getting to know you and you all never getting to know her, and it just didn't seem right to me, so I just don't leave her home. If I can't afford to take her, then I don't go, but she's sort of like the wind beneath my wings, been good for me, and I want you all to meet her. So, Gail, will you stand up? She's a very lovely lady, and we've had a good life together for the past 30 years. My sponsor sent her to Al-Anon. I never married when I drank, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But after I'd been sober about 10 months or so, I said to Hillary one night, I said, I'm getting very serious about a lady. And he said, bring her up here. I said, what am I going to bring her up here for? He said, I told you to. I said, oh, I understand that. If you had one of those kind of sponsors, you understood them back then. You didn't have much to say. You didn't know anything. I was sober a year, and they let me talk. For the first 12 months I was sober, I thought I was deaf and dumb. You didn't have anything to say. You stayed sober by going to meetings, not drinking, and getting in the car. And I understood the don't drink and go to meetings, but get in the car, they'd holler at you. And the reason for it was no newcomer had a car. And so if you went to a meeting, you went with them, and they'd drop you off in the driveway at 6:30 and said, I'll be here tomorrow night at 6:30, and you be ready. And they'd back out of the driveway. And you'd sit there all day long trying to figure out why you couldn't go. If Yogi Bear was on television or something real important had come up, you know, and so they'd wheel in the driveway about 6:30, and you'd dash out to the car and say, look, I'd really like to go, but you get in the car. But you don't understand, get in the damn car. So I got in the car for 365 days. So I didn't drink and went to meetings and got in the car. You just did what they told you to do. I get sort of amazed today around A, so you'll hear somebody say, he took my inventory. You bet your boots they'd take your inventory. In a heartbeat, you know. Some of those old clubs had inventory rooms. They did, you know. The damn door was marked inventory room. And when you walked in there and your sponsor saw you and he said, come here. You bet your boots he'd take your inventory in a heartbeat. And it was real neat, those old guys. They were something. It's a shame that many of you newcomers never have an opportunity to meet some of them. They were people, and I'm just like them because I believe that there's one word in Alcoholics Anonymous that's more important than anything they'll ever write or anything they'll ever say or anything they'll ever print. It's the word identification. They were absolutely sure for an alcoholic to recover, you had to identify with the people here in this room. And when you could do that, you could then become like them. And that identification was going to come about because you were going to sit and listen. You know, you didn't know anything to begin with. What the hell did you have to talk about? If you knew anything, you wouldn't have been here. You know? And all those guys were old. I was 33 and they called me boy. And they'd look at you then when you were 33 about, you know, why is he here? Look how young he is. And now look at them, how young they are. Some of those old guys yet even today don't think you ought to be here that young. I had an old guy down home. I asked one of them kids one day. He said, how old are you, boy? And boy said to him, 20. He said, 20? He said, I spilled more whiskey than you ever drank. And that kid looked at him and said, well, maybe if you drank some of it instead of spilled it, you got here quicker, you old bastard. And I don't know, he might have. But interesting. It was interesting. Time of AA and an interesting time in my life, and it's just been great. Since I've been coming here, I've been okay. And that's why I keep coming back. By myself, I was nothing from the very beginning, I guess, and so I don't want to go back out there by myself anymore. So that's why after 30 years, I still go to 5 AA meetings a week and help where I can, because I know what I need here. And in that process of helping me, if I can pass that on or share that with you, then that's fine. I still believe the definition of a sponsor is I talk, you listen. And if that doesn't suit you, then find somebody else. I'm a firm believer that if you knew anything, you wouldn't be here. If you had something to say, we'd be willing to listen. But I can't even the slightest idea what you would know. And that's how you learn. You learn from listening, and it's what you learn here from listening is when you really begin to know something. That's why AA says it's what you know after you know it all that counts. And I saw a bumper sticker one time reminded me of myself. It said, hire a teenager while they still know everything. And I thought, boy, that fit me. I don't tell jokes from behind the podium. I tell stories occasionally, but I wouldn't tell a story if it wasn't true. And every story that I'll tell you is true, and I know it's true because alcoholic told me. And the ones I know don't lie. My wife doesn't believe a damn one of them, but I can't help that. They were told to me by some of the pillars of this program. And I know they wouldn't lie. We had an Al-Anon lady down in Louisville, whose husband just kept drinking. He never would quit drinking, never did quit drinking, and he finally died. And she had him cremated. And she took his ashes and mixed them with some marijuana and smoked him. And she went all over the country telling people, that's the first time in 25 years that sucker ever made her feel good. And that's a true story because an ex-delegate told me that. And I know he wouldn't lie. I come from Louisville, Kentucky. I was born and raised there, in out around the corner at 4th and Central, where Churchill Downs Racetrack is where I was initiated into life and all of its activities. And I tell you that I was born and raised there because, for me, that's good English. I spoke somewhere one night, my father and stepmother were in the audience, and I said I was born and raised, and my stepmother corrected me after the meeting. She said, it's not good English. And don't talk like that behind a podium in front of a large group of people. Tell them you were born and reared. That's proper English, born and reared. She said, anything that's raised has absolutely no intelligent form of life. And my father looked at her and said, leave him alone. He knows what the hell he's talking about. So I can tell you that I was born and raised around that corner. I come from a good family, like most of us do. I have an older brother who is an executive with the General Motors Corporation. Went and when he got out of high school, he had an opportunity to go to GM Tech, and he got a good education and a degree in industrial engineering and had a terrific job with them. I have two younger sisters who were normal, whatever that is. They married when they were 20 years old, I guess, and still had the same husband, had about four kids, and there was me. And I did real good till I was about 16. I don't really know of anything to tell you until I was about 16. You know, I don't know what I'm an adult child of, but I don't even think they have groups for adult children of normal parents, do they? We might start one. It would be interesting. I haven't been the same since they treated me nice, you know. Whatever. And I got out to the corner, and World War II was just about over. And I tried behind these podiums to share with you what the big book of AA asked me to. Experience, strength, and hope. And I know tonight that an experience is something you learn from. And if you haven't had an experience, it means you haven't learned anything from it. You've had a lot of happenings in your life. I have a t-shirt I love. I was wearing it around here. A lot of people ask me if it's got Wile E. Coyote on it. You ever watch Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner? Wile's an alcoholic. Hell, you know Wile's an alcoholic. He does the same thing over and over and over again, expecting different results. You know? He's got one enabler, that Acme Tool Company, that keeps mailing him all that crap, and he keeps believing tomorrow's going to be different. You know? And he goes flying by stand that says, how to catch a roadrunner. You think he'd stop and ask? Hell no. You know, he'll do it his way. And, that's the story of my life. And when I got out to that corner, life began. I was about 15, 16 years old. World War II was just about over. Everything was rationed, and I went to work at a gas station at night with an older guy who was about 20 years old. And when people would come in to buy gasoline with those gas ration coupons, a lot of the older people didn't use them all that they had. And at the end of the month, they would give you a book, and there might be 8 or 10 coupons in that book that they hadn't used. You'd post them on those sheets that went to Washington, and you had 400 or 500 gallons of gas down in the ground. You could sell without the coupon. Now, there was guys around that corner that had a lot of liquor stores and beer joints around that racetrack, and they had plenty of the good whiskey and good beer. You couldn't buy it, but they had it, and they didn't have any gasoline for those Cadillacs. And they'd come down to the gas station, we'd fill the Cadillacs up, and they'd leave the good whiskey and the good beer, and we'd put it in a storeroom, and we'd either drink it or sell it. And that's really where I learned to drink. There was a guy who ran a drugstore over there on the corner of 3rd and Central, and he had the good cigarettes, which you couldn't buy. All you old guys remember that. You couldn't buy Lucky's or Chesterfields or Camels or the good cigarettes, but he had a couple of Cadillacs and no gasoline. He'd bring the Cadillacs over, we'd fill them up, and he'd leave the cigarettes there. And we'd put them in a storeroom, and we'd either smoke them or sell them. And that's where I learned to smoke. And there were some girls around there that didn't have any gasoline. You'll have to draw your own conclusions about the rest of that story, but I was on my way. I was introduced to booze, to cigarettes, to sex, and to racehorses. And I'm telling you, it was a wonderful experience. I had money in my pocket and everything good in life that a man can dream of. And I don't have to tell, you know, any of you all about that. You already know. You see a lot of the young ones around here tonight, and I'm sure they're tied up in the same damn thing, except I had no idea what price tag was on it. I tell all the young people at home that I sponsor, I can't make you do anything. You decide what you want to do. If you haven't had enough, go have some more. But one nice thing about coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, you will learn there's a price tag for everything you do. And if you're willing to pay the price, go do it. And the only thing about it is sometimes you don't know the exact price because you might be paralyzed or incarcerated or dead. But if it's your desire to go do it, then go pay the price. And I paid a hell of a price for the next 13 years. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 33 years old. But I don't think Alcoholics Anonymous would have helped me prior to that time. I know all of that is hypothetical. The reason I say it is that my experience in AA has taught me there's only two kinds of people that seem to darken our doors. There are those people who can learn from others, and there are those people who have to have their own experiences before they can learn a damn thing. They used to tell a story years ago, I haven't heard it lately, about two guys went in a bar to get something to drink, an alcoholic and a social drinker. And they went out the back door and the guy hit him in the head with a ball bat. And the next night they came back to drink and the social drinker went out the front door and the alcoholic went out the back door and the guy hit him in the head with a ball bat. And the third night the social drinker went out the front door, the alcoholic went out the back door, the guy with the ball bat wasn't there, so he sat down and waited for him. Now, that is a true story, probably, because that's just exactly the way that we are. I could never learn from anybody. You know, I had to do it my way. Now, the big book talks about people like me, a self-willed run riot and what have you. But, you know, nobody could tell me anything. And even when I got in AA for the first year, I was, just very, very obnoxious to a lot of people. I was what the 12 and 12 talks about. I was a defiant individual. You know, I just had a real hard time adjusting to the fact that if I was to survive, I had to start becoming one of those people who could learn from others. And when other people would tell me what they had experienced in life, I didn't have to do it if I would use theirs. And that was a very, very difficult thing for me. But that's the only kind of people you see coming in here. There are people who can learn from others and people who have to have it their own damn way, come hell or high water. I was telling a psychiatrist friend of mine one day, we were talking about this, and he told me a story I'll share with you. It was about a lady who owned a parrot, and the parrot was foul-mouthed, got it cussed unbelievably foul-mouthed, and she couldn't do anything with it. And she got mad at it one day and threw it in the freezer. And after a while, she felt sorry for the parrot and let him out of the freezer and looked at him, and she said, "When are you going to learn to quit cussing?" And the parrot said, "You don't have to worry about me anymore. I'll never cuss again as long as I live." He said, "But tell me," he said, "what the hell did that turkey do?" But you see, the parrot learned from the turkey. And I'm sure that sitting in this very room tonight, there's some parrots in here. And you can learn from the people who've gone before you in this program. But you can bet your boots there's some turkeys sitting in here. There's a lot of you, they'll have to skin you, wrap you, and freeze your ass before you'll ever learn anything. And I want you to know you're looking at the biggest turkey of them all. I was a turkey personified. I couldn't learn from anybody. Knew it all. My mother died when I was about 19 years old. My father and I were the ones who really went round and round. I had no use for my father. I didn't like my father. And he felt the same way about me with my conduct, the people I was with, how long I stayed, what I did when I got there, and all those various kind of things. I just really never had any love or feelings for my father, and I drove my father away. My father told me one time later on, and thank God he lived for 8 years of my sobriety. And Patty and I were talking about this at dinner. I'm eternally grateful that I had that opportunity of those 8 years with my dad, because we became the best of friends that ever was. And we could sit and talk about many, many, many things. My father was a firm believer that if you're looking for a helping hand, it's on the end of your own arm. And he said, "The only regrets I have that neither one of us knew where to put it." And when I was looking for a helping hand and it was here, I had no idea I could come to place it in yours and be okay, because I knew nothing about you, and neither did my father. And we had hell, believe me. And I never had a decent, kind word from my father. Until I was about 20 years old, I was arrested, and it changed my opinion of my father. It's a fascinating thing about what a squad car in a jail does for people like you and I. It changes our opinions of the people we know. It just automatically does that. Did you ever go down to a corner bar somewhere and listen to that guy talk about that old bitch he lives with? Lock him up. He'll call, she'll answer, and he'll say, "Honey. Honey." All because of a jail. And my father and I didn't get along at all. I was arrested when I was 20 years old for the very first time. I dropped a dime in the telephone, and he answered. Instead of being a dumbass old man, I said, "Daddy, Daddy." He said, "What do you want?" I said, "I'm in jail." He said, "Why'd you call me?" I said, "Well, I thought you might come down here and get me out." "Oh," he said, "I wouldn't worry about that if I was you." Well, I was worried about it. He said, "As smart as you are," "Oh," he said, "I'm sure if you figured a way to get in, you'll figure a way to get out." And he hung up. And when I ran into him somewhere along the way again, he said to me, "I've never been in jail. I understand they allow you one phone call. If I was you, I wouldn't waste it." Well, I never called him anymore. He didn't seem to have any understanding of that. But that's just about the way that he felt. My father said to me one day, he said, "I hope you never have to experience it." And up to this point, I haven't. But he said, "I hope you never have to experience the emotional effect it has on a human being to look at someone and dearly love them for who they are and totally despise them for what they've become." He said, "I loved you dearly as a son, and I literally hated your guts for what you had become." I said, "You mean you loved an alcoholic and hated alcoholism?" And he said, "That's exactly right." And he said, "I just hope to God you never have to experience that." And up to this point, I haven't. I drank for the next 13 years. I went to work for the Louisville and Nashville Railroad Company down there while I got a job with them through him. He was in the personnel department there, and it was embarrassing as hell to him. I don't know, why he wanted me to go to work there, but I did. And I played that game of alcoholism for the next 13 years. I tried every way known to God or man not to drink. I tried every way known to God or man to live comfortably and peacefully in that society without it. And then I tried every way known to God or man to control the amount of the stuff that made me feel good. I tried as hard as I could try, and I never succeeded. And I'm just a typical alcoholic who was a victim of alcoholism, because the most difficult time in my life was when I was sober. You know, and that's why alcoholics, I think, drink alcohol. I cannot stand the misery of sobriety. And when I was away from that environment and not doing what they did in there, you know, I just became miserable. I was very irresponsible and undependable. I had absolutely no feelings about anything or anybody. You know, it was all my way. I wanted things my way. To do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and my sponsor said to me, "You have to stop doing what you want to do. You have to start doing what you need to do. And when you do what you need to do long enough, it sets you free to do what you want to do." And I thought, he's talking in circles. What the hell is he talking about? Stop doing what you want to do and do what you need to do. It sets you free to do what you want to do. And the reason for that is my wants changed. He told me one time when I was new in AA that if I ever wanted to have a spiritual awakening, the first thing I must do is to realize there's somebody else on this planet besides me. And when the day comes that you can realize that we're all part of a triangle, we're all part of a trinity, there's me and you and God, and until I can recognize that fact, I can never live at peace with myself or anybody else. As long as I operate in a world where the only thing that's important is what I want to do, and when I don't get my way, I'll go crawl in a hole somewhere and pout. And to hell with what you want me to do. And that's the way that I live. And it is no wonder. You know, when I look at what AA had to offer me and what AA has done for me, and the, as you have here on your slogan, the courage to change. Once I could change, things changed. Nothing changed till I changed. Nothing will change in your life till you change. And the thing you need to change is everything. And you know, when I look at AA today and look at how I live today and how I think today and how I believe today, it is totally in contradiction of what I thought for the first 33 years I was on this earth. And I just feel blessed that I was fortunate enough to survive it. Because I really didn't give a damn about anything or anybody. I'll share one drunkalog story with you. I had been doing pretty good one time with my father. I got back on the good side of him. I was living at home again. Everybody at the railroad was proud of me. I'd had a drink in 4 or 5 months. And one Saturday morning, my father asked me to go get a retriever spring for a screen door. And I walked down to the hardware store to get a retriever spring, and on the way down, a guy opened a saloon door and hollered at me. He said, "Where you been?" I said, "Oh, I haven't been drinking." He said, "I know. I haven't seen you." And I said, "No, I haven't been around." He said, "Why don't you come on in? It's Saturday, we'll ride up to Keeneland, Lexington, Kentucky, and go to races." "No, I better not." I said, "I got to go get a spring for a screen door." "Oh, come on in." Well, I went in. He said, "You sure you won't go up to the races with us?" And I said, "No, I better not." He said, "Have a beer." I said, "No, I better not drink. I don't do too well." "Well, why don't you quit all of that crazy drinking? Come on, have a beer." I said, "Okay." I had a beer, and him and I went to Keeneland Racetrack on a Saturday morning, and I came back 8 days later. And we ran into two elderly ladies at Keeneland Racetrack who wanted to keep us. They wanted to keep us, and we wanted to stay, so it was an interesting 8 days. I hadn't gone to work and didn't give a damn if they knew where I was or didn't care whether I had a job, didn't care about anything. That's just the way I was. When I finally got home, my clothes were back in a Kroger bag, and my father said, "Out." And he looked at me and he said, "Damn, that hardware store must have been crowded." And I said to him when I got sober, I said, "How come you never confronted me and got verbal or violent or argumentative?" And he said, I knew I'd lose it. He said, I knew that if that ever happened, I'd kill you. And he said, "I'm dead serious. There were Hilrich and Bradby baseball bats all over our house." And he said, "I'd have broke your neck with one of them." And he said, "I knew if I ever lost it, you were dead. And I wasn't going to let you do that to me. I would not react to you in a manner to hurt me." He didn't even know anything about Al-Anon, but isn't that what they teach him? I'm serious. He didn't know anything about AA, but isn't that what they teach us? "I will not react in a manner to you that hurts me." Many, many, many years ago, I walked in an AA meeting with my old sponsor, and a guy was standing at the door and said, "How are you doing tonight, Hillary?" He said, "I'm doing just fine." And he walked 2 or 3 steps past that guy, and he turned around and came back. He said, "You know, young man, I haven't had very many bad days since I quit doing things to hurt me." And I thought about that, and I thought about that, and isn't that true? How many of us have had bad days since we've quit doing things to hurt ourselves? How many of us have had bad days since we quit reacting to other people in a manner that destroyed us? And that's what the game, and I'm sure that's all it is, that's the game my father would not play. For the next 13 years, it was pure, unadulterated hell. As I got older and got worse, I don't have to tell you that story, you already know it. I went from a fairly respectable young teenager to a fairly respectable guy in the middle 20s to where I couldn't live with them anymore, and I got me an apartment. I couldn't pay for it anymore, and I got me a one-room house, and I couldn't pay for it anymore, and I went into a flop house, and I couldn't pay for it anymore, and I went to the city streets. And I became a wino on Skid Row, and I lived there about a year and a half. And it's not a great, big, interesting story to tell you. Everybody known to God or man tried to stop me from getting to where I wound up. And they all tried to do it with fear. And how do you stop an alcoholic? By interjecting fear into somebody that's scared to death. How do you interject fear into somebody that lives in a world of fear, whether it's reality or fantasy, it's present in there. And it's seeming to be the thing that engulfs and destroys most all of us. And we've become so fearful at times we isolate ourselves into a state of loneliness, which I think is the most destructive thing in any human mind. I know of nothing. The book called it the chilling vapor of loneliness. And I became a victim of all of that. And everybody that was in my path tried to stop me. My father said if you don't quit drinking, you get out of the house. The priest said you're going to hell. The doctor said you're going to die. The cop says you're going to jail. The judge says you're going to prison. The boss said you're going to the unemployment line. Everything that was going to happen to you if you don't quit. The interjection of fear. Little did they realize that people like me do not survive in that world out there by ourselves. And the most horrible times of our life is sobriety, when there's nobody there but us in our own mind. You know, we were thinking people. Old guy told me years ago, he said, quit thinking. He said, think of your mind as a real bad neighborhood. Never go in there alone. And I tried to think of my mind as a real bad neighborhood. Don't go in there alone. You get in a whole lot of trouble. But nothing helped, obviously. You know, and it never does. I've seen experts try to help people quit drinking, scare them to death. A lady in Louisville tried everything known to God or man to get her husband to quit, and he wouldn't quit. And she went down to a costume shop and bought a devil's suit and put that damn suit on and hid behind a hedge that went around her house. And he come home one night drunk, and she leaped out from behind that hedge in that devil's suit. And she looked at him, and she said, I've come to get you. And that old drunk looked at her, and he said, well, who are you? He said, I am the devil. He stuck his hand out. He said, my God, put her there. He said, I've been wanting to meet you ever since I married your sister. It didn't help him. I wandered around that skid row doing what people on skid row do, trying to hustle a buck, hustle a pint or whatever, you know, something to drink. You eventually, those of you who've been there know, you drink for oblivion. There's nothing that'll tell you tomorrow will be better than today. If you can get enough where you don't have to think, then that tormenting of your mind is the most horrible thing in the world, and it's the most uninteresting place in the world to ever be. And I was there for about a year or so. The only interesting story I know, and I sometimes think about this, that makes me realize there's a lot of dumb people out there that don't drink. There was a hardware store there, and some of my friends who've been to Louisville, like Fred, and some of them, I've showed them that alley. It's a historical site now that Chris wanted to know if Sullivan Business College was named after me in Louisville. I told him no, but that Sullivan Alley was. It's a filthy alley that runs down through there, and that's where we lived. And there was a hardware store there, and they threw out cardboard boxes, and that's what we slept in. Cardboard's a great insulator. If there's any of you out there that's got some more drinking, you might want to write that down. It's C-A-R-D-B-O-A-R-D. But it really will keep the cold and the rain and everything off of you. So when that hardware store, and a nice thing about it, you can be a snob wino. If you got there early and got one of them big freezer boxes, you can lay down in them. And you see some guy dragging over one of them old TV console boxes trying to curl up in it, you know, and you think, God, we ought to get rid of him. He's running the neighborhood or something like that. You kind of be snobbish, too. And I borrowed some money from a finance company, and I'd forgot to pay them, and it had gone on for about a year and a half. So it was an enormous debt. Started out at $500, but it escalates real quickly with those people. But they couldn't find me, and they were upset about it. And finally, a bartender squealed on me. He said, look back there in that cardboard jungle. He's back there somewhere. And this guy comes snooping around there this day. It was sort of a cold, rainy day, and I saw him snooping around there. You knew he didn't belong. He had on a suit and a tie, and he's looking around there, and he saw me sitting in one of them freezer boxes and had a day-old racing for him and a pint of wine, and he finally got up enough courage. He had the courage to change, I guess, and he came over to where I was sitting in this box, and he knocked on my box, and I opened the flap to let him in, you know. He said something I still don't know to this night what he meant. He said, are you Jack Sullivan? I said, yes, sir. He said, you know, you borrowed some money from us about a year or so ago, and you haven't paid a damn dime on it. I said, yeah. He said, I'm going to tell you something. If you don't start making some payments on this loan, he said, you're going to be in a hell of a lot of trouble. And I don't know to this day what the hell he meant. You know, you couldn't tar and feather people, but anyway, that was taken care of after I got sober. But I thought I'd die there. You know, you begin to realize there is no alternative to what you are. And that is when a sense of hopelessness sets into the alcoholic. I believe that anybody that has a feeling of hope is someone who believes you will be better tomorrow than you were today. That you can succeed tomorrow where you failed today. That is someone who has hope. But you reach a point in your life, and especially back then, especially back there, to where you knew. And it's a horrible, horrible thing to swallow when you know that every day will be like this day for the rest of your life. And I think the thing that keeps people like me from committing suicide under those kind of conditions is that I was just never able to convince myself, even under those dire circumstances, that that's where my life was meant to end. That from day one, I was destined to be here. I had a good father. My mother was dead. I had two sisters who were okay. My brother was an executive with General Motors. You know, and I thought, here I sit. And I was able to blame everybody in the world, and I hated everybody in the world, and I didn't like God, and he didn't like me, and we was even. You know, and I had absolutely no feelings about anything or anybody. And you start to live in an emotionless state. And it's real sickening and real horrible and real scary. You know, and trust me when I tell you that no matter how much booze you can get your hands on, you know, nothing will help you. You drink for oblivion. I'm sitting in the back room of a saloon that morning on the 21st day of August of 1962, and little did I know my life was about to change. My father walked in the back door of that saloon with a man I never saw before in my life. And when I saw my father, I didn't want him to see me looking like that. I knew that he knew. I hadn't seen him or talked to him in a long, long time. But I had a feeling that he knew, that people told him about me, that I was dirty, I had long hair and a beard, my clothes were filthy, all my teeth had been kicked out, I suffered from malnutrition and dehydration, I had turned two or three different colors, I was yellow and green and blue, you know, and I was swollen from the dehydration and malnutrition. I was just a pitiful looking piece of human flesh. And for some reason, as loud and as macho as I professed to be, I didn't want my father to see me looking like that. But I had no choice when he walked in the door and a stranger was with him. I had no idea who he was or why he was there. And my father went over and sat on some stools that went around a lunch counter in the back end of this saloon, and the guy was with him came to a table where I sat. He was a very distinguished looking man. He had on a suit and a tie and his gray hair and he always smiled. And he came to where I was with a smile on his face and he stuck his hand out, wanted to shake hands with me. And he said, "Hi, my name is Jack. I understand so is yours." And I said, "Yes." He said, "I'm a friend of your father's and I've heard about you through your father, through a vice president on the L&N Railroad. And he said, "I've come out here to help you. I hope you'll let me. I can't help you if you won't let me." And I had to ask him the obvious question, you know, why? Why would a stranger take time out from whatever it was he had to do in his life to come to a place like that to see somebody like me? It made no sense to me. And I said, "Why, you know, why, stranger, would you care about me?" And he made the most profound statement I've ever heard in my life, here or anywhere else. I don't ever expect to hear one more profound. When he looked at me and he just smiled, as he always did, he said, "I've come here because I used to be like you are, and somebody helped me. And that's why I'm here. I used to be like you are. And somebody helped me. And that's why I'm here. And that's why I'm here. And that's why wherever you see me, wherever I'm at an AA meeting, in Louisville, Kentucky, or anywhere else, and somebody says, 'Why are you here?' I used to be like you are. And somebody helped me. and that's why I'm here. He said, come on, go with us. I have made arrangements to have you admitted to a psychiatric hospital in Louisville by a doctor. And he said, I hope you'll come and go with us. And those old guys, even in AA then, were sarcastic as hell. Yeah. And I said, you want me to go looking like this? And he said, of course not. Do you have a place to change? And I thought, excuse me.